This podcast is a quest for well-being, a quest for a meaningful life through the exploration of fundamental truth. Enlightening ideas, insights on physical, mental, and spiritual health. The inspiration is love. The aspiration is to awaken new ways of thinking that can lead us to a new way of being. Being well. Welcome to Body, Mind, and Soul Healing Conversations.
Life is everywhere, and we are connected to it. In the web of life, everything has a purpose and is part of the ecology of the planet. Our dogs help me see all this. It starts with their curiosity, their need to inspect every little thing on a walk and then do it again the next day. Every being has a purpose. Follow a dog or a child. Explore a little. Ask one question, which leads to another. And then a whole new world appears before you. Children and dogs. On a walk, the most important thing to do is be curious. We walk for all sorts of reasons. We decompress. We count steps. We listen to music. We make lists. If we are not alone, we talk. Yet, if we follow our dog's nose, if we spend a bit more time wondering about where that plant, that flower, that mysterious jackrabbit, their head and ears peeking out from a bush, came from, and we do it repeatedly, the biosphere emerges before us as astonishing and interconnected. We walk in a sacred space. Life connected, life dependent. Nothing stands, walks, runs, creeps, swims, slithers, sends out shoots or roots independently. Every living creature has a past, a history that takes it back to those single-cell ancestors 4 billion years ago. It is the great oneness. Valeria interviews Hirsch Wilson. He is the author of Dog Lessons, Learning the Important Stuff from Our Best Friends, Play to Win, Choosing Growth Over Fear in Work and Life, Firefighter Zen, A Field Guide to Thriving in Tough Times, and Test of Faith, a novel of faith and murder in the Southwest. Hirsch Wilson has worked, as in jobs he was actually paid for, as a corn pollinator, a Ferris wheel operator, a short order cook, a ballet dancer, an outdoor educator, a soccer coach, a leadership consultant, a pilot, and a writer. The Ferris wheel operating was the strangest job. Lots of physics involved. Along the way, he was also a volunteer firefighter EMT for 33 years, which culminated in the award-winning book Firefighter Zen, A Field Guide for Thriving in Tough Times. Most importantly, he's the partner of Lori Wilson, father of two daughters and grandfather of two. For over 60 years, he's also been a dog guardian. He has co-written three national business bestsellers with his father, Larry Wilson, including the award-winning Play to Win, Choosing Growth Over Fear in Work and in Life. Hirsch attended Colorado College and quit his junior year to follow his passion, dance. He performed in Canada, Switzerland, and the United States. After that career ended, he graduated with a BA in English from the University of Minnesota. Hirsch and Lori live in Santa Fe, New Mexico, with their daughter Sully and two rescue dogs, Toby, a Great Pyrenees, and Maisie, a Terrier Chihuahua mix. His latest book is Dog Lessons, Learning the Important Stuff from Our Best Friends. You can follow on Medium.com at Hirsch Wilson, on X, Twitter, at Braving Fires, on Instagram at Hirsch Wilson, and on his website, HirschWilson.com. You can order Hirsch's books at your favorite bookstore or wherever books are sold. Or you can go to our wonderful bookstore in Santa Fe, Collected Works, order in person or online. Meet Hirsch at HirschWilson.com. Here's the interview with Hirsch Wilson.
In your own words, who is Hirsch Wilson?
Well, thank you for asking. I'm a 74-year-old grandfather, former firefighter. I was a firefighter for 33 years, father of two daughters, and grandfather of a granddaughter and a grandson. So that's that kind of what's most important in my life right now. And I have been fortunate to kind of follow my dreams no matter what age I've been. So I think I talk about working as a Ferris wheel operator as a young child, pollinating corn, being a ballet dancer, being a pilot, being a facilitator for large organizations. And then my most recent endeavor has been writing books.
Yes. And I'm curious to know which of these roles do you love most? Do you enjoy the most or have enjoyed?
Oh, boy. Well, I think dancing was probably the thing where I used most of my ambition in my life and most of my passion in my life.
Yeah.
So that I was a dancer from age 19 to age 30.
Wow.
And I think that taught me just how beautiful the arts are, how important the arts are, and taught me discipline, which was something I really needed and helped me throughout the rest of my career.
Wow. What is it about dancing? You know, I usually say that. I actually start almost all conversations I have here. Let's dance. It's something that comes naturally to me. It's I know it's coming probably from a spiritual perspective, perception of myself in the world, that we hear everything here is just moving, dancing, as universe intelligence and doing what it does.
Yes, I think dancing, I think you have to go back and realize that as human beings, we've always danced. We've danced for joy. We've danced for sorrow. We've danced for all sorts of reasons. And unfortunately, I think our Western culture has eliminated or disrespects not only the spirituality aspect of it, but the idea of dancing. Part of that is in America is because of our puritanical roots, where you know, if you're a true Puritan, you never want to see anybody having any fun. And I think I think that's really influenced us, because I think dancing, I think there is a time, and I think this is true for all artists, where you get so subsumed in the dance, so subsumed in movement that you forget who you are, and you just become the music, you become the dance. And that is that to me is probably one of the highest spiritual experiences you can have.
Wow. Oh, yes, a billion times to that truth. Yes, becoming the dance itself. Yes. How wonderful. I didn't expect to hear that from you. Of course, that's a very powerful, empowering, and truth with capital T to me.
I think one of the things I've come to realize is that we are many things. We are not just our career. We're not just our job. We're not just our roles, parent or daughter or son. We are many, many things. And part of life, the journey of life, is discovering all those aspects of ourselves and celebrating them and worshiping them. And I've had the pleasure and the opportunity to do that.
Wow. Yes. What a beautiful metaphor for life itself. Yes. Right. That dancers, artists in general, you said, but specifically dancers, they at some point they forget who they are and only the movement remains. As life moves.
I think that right. And I've had the same experience as a firefighter, where as a firefighter and a medic, an EMT, you become so involved with your team in solving somebody else's worst day of their lives that you forget who you are. You forget yourself because you're so involved in serving somebody else. And it's just somewhat the same thing.
Yes.
Where you get out of that, you lose your ego, you forget your ego. You're there for somebody else, or you're there for a higher purpose.
Wow. Yes. So that's to say that the only thing that really aspect of us that separates us from life itself universe, God, whatever we call that, is really thinking. It's belief systems, right, Hirsch?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
It really is. It's
absolutely.
Believing that we are
absolutely.
Yeah, and a separate entity, individual.
Yeah.
Ah, yeah. How did you come to this realization? By experience itself or Buddhism? I know you're also a beginner Buddhist.
Right. I think I came to it, I think firefighting, being a firefighter for 33 years taught me that, I think when you experience people in their worst moments, when they need help, you realize a couple things. You realize, one, that we all need help. We all need support. That as human beings are not meant to be individuals alone in the world. We are communal beings. We need social support. And that's where we get our highest meaning. The idea of the Lone Ranger and John Wayne and the kind of the American individual idea is myth. It's illusion, really. And I think as a firefighter, you learn that quite quickly, that we need each other.
Mm. Wow, what a beautiful lesson right there. You know, I know you wrote a book, Firefighter Zen, right? A Field of Guide,
correct,
Thriving in
right.
Tough Times. Is that where you, do you talk about this philosophy there openly?
Yes.
Yeah, this sounds very spiritual to me.
Yeah.
Oh, that's why you call firefighters Zen, right? I didn't read that book.
Right, right.
I think
Buddhism, Buddhism is just, I think we all need structure. I think we all need a belief system. And I think we spend so much time looking for the perfect one that we forget that that perfection is the enemy of the good. And to me, Buddhism aligned with my existing belief systems and taught me, I think, the most important lesson that you learn as the firefighter, but really reinforces it with Buddhism. And that's the idea of being kind, that to the extent we can be kind in the world, we really give back to the world.
Mm.
And it doesn't take a whole lot of effort. We have to move our ego out of the way and just say, I'm going to be kind no matter how people treat me. Mm. My mission is to be kind. And whether you're Christian or Muslim or Buddhist, that message resonates across most religions.
Mm, yes, that's fundamental. Yes, right. The message of love and the message that there is something beyond the human existence. I think that's all religions, right? They point to that. Mm-hmm. Yes. It's kindness. That's one of my guiding principles. But I have had some challenges with that concept in applying it.
Sure.
Is that I was trying to be nice, I guess. Some people, they call it, you know, being nice instead of kind. So I was trying just too hard to please others, but then saying yes when I really meant to say no. So that was hurting me.
Right.
I was not really in a good place.
Right.
Right. So
I think as a firefighter, because as in firefighting and emergency medical services, you're always dealing with difficult people. Mm-hmm. It just comes with the job. Mm-hmm. And a lot of it is, you know, we're going through a kind of an epidemic of mental illness in this country right now and drug abuse and then dealing with people with trauma. They're stripped. Their ability to be, you know, socially appropriate is gone. So we have the saying in the fire department, first try to be kind.
Mm.
And then if you can't be kind, be nice.
Mm.
Right?
Right.
And that's kind of what we teach people coming into it, because it's very easy if someone's yelling at you, if someone's screaming at you, if someone hits you or strikes you, it's very easy to strike back and hit back. But we really, as professionals, want to be kind and want to be, if can't be kind, be nice.
Mm.
And if can't be nice, be respectful.
Mm, I see. Yeah. So there's, it's almost like steps to it. I like that.
Right.
I never heard it
right.
that way. Mm, yeah.
Yeah. And I think one big example that goes on every day in the emergency services is how we treat people who are struggling with addiction. If I think addiction to heroin or fentanyl is a moral choice, right?
Yeah.
And I get paged at 4 o'clock in the morning to go see the same addict for the fourth or fifth time this month, I'm going to get upset and mad. But if I understand that addiction is a disease, right? If it's not something that somebody willingly wants to do, but it's a disease, then it allows me to be more compassionate. So how I think about the world, how I choose to show up in the world is super important for how I end up treating people.
Yes, and that choice comes from belief systems, right, Hirsch? Because we are just acting out our beliefs here.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and I think one of them is to believe that we are the body only. I love what you said about, if you can be kind, then be nice. And if you can be nice, be respectful. And then that's mm-hmm. something that I had this insight into gratitude. So I had a lot mm-hmm. of issues happening here. The time changed with the daylight savings. And then it was just, my mind was all over the place. I couldn't sleep well. And then we had a roof. What do you call roof remodeling, like in the neighbor's house?
Right.
Gosh, it was so like chaotic. And then I just reflected on, I'm not happy. I can't be loving right now. I can't be kind. What else can I be? And then what came to me was grateful. I'm grateful to be alive. Mm-hmm. I'm grateful to be able to hear mm-hmm. even the noise, mm-hmm. be able to perceive mm-hmm. chaos. So mm-hmm. what is your take on gratitude?
I think my daughter who lives with us, she's 30, and she makes us do a gratitude exercise every night mm-hmm. just to think about what we're grateful for this day. And I look at it and it's a simple thing, just like hearing my daughter and my wife laugh together makes me incredibly grateful. knowing that in my family right now, everybody's alive. Everybody's healthy. I'm enormously grateful. So I think part of it starts with understanding what your expectations are. And if your expectations are attached to reality, which a lot of ours are not, but if they're attached to reality, knowing that everybody's healthy and alive and have careers and are loved, that to me is... it can't get better than that. It just can't get better than that.
Mm.
I'm from a spiritual point of view, I think of it this way. For all of us who are born, there lies an infinity of time, billions and billions and billions of years. And after we pass away, the same thing. It's infinity, billions and billions and billions of years that we're here on this blue-green planet, on an outside perimeter of the Milky Way, is astonishing. It's a miracle.
Yes.
It depends on no matter how you define miracle, from a spiritual sense or a physics sense, it's just extraordinary. And so, once you understand that and you grasp the reality of our being, to me, it's just. Like every day is like, oh my God, I'm alive. I cannot believe I'm alive. And I think that's kind of where I come from fundamentally. I have bad days, just like everybody has bad days. Days where you don't want to talk to anybody. Mm-hmm. The only people you want to talk, the only beings you want to talk to are your dogs.
yes.
But behind that is that extraordinary experience of being alive in an incredibly vast and timeless universe.
Ah, that's truly beautiful. Gosh, Hirsch, you just have so much timeless wisdom that I don't even know where to begin now, how to continue the conversation. I mean, amazing. I love that. I love everything about it. Thank you for sharing your heart. Let me just wait a moment. It's interesting. Noise has been my the theme this week here. Noise everywhere. Yeah. And I have been, asking for truth that in any moment, like, please, what can I see here? What am I to see? Gratitude was one of them. And it's interesting that mm-hmm. you talk so much about it now in a very profound spiritual way. We wish for everyone to be able to live this truth, right? That this is a miracle to be here. And mm-hmm. I think compassion, you spoke of compassion earlier in Buddhism, they teach a lot of that. It comes in handy when you just see other people suffering out of this belief system that they, the life is suffering, the life is not good. Mm-hmm. And I remember looking at somebody, my husband, about a week ago, something happened and I think he said something negative towards himself, like a set negative self-talk. And immediately something in me got very emotional, like, oh, I wish he only knew how complete and whole you are already, how this is what you're looking for, that you are what you're looking for. And that made me cry because I don't think we can teach those things. I don't know, Hirsch, do you... I have these conversations with you all the time, but the world doesn't seem to change that much. People around me, they seem to be the same way.
Yeah, I think one of the most important tenets of Buddhism is that there's suffering in life.
Yeah.
And if you look around, whether you look at the history of humanity or whether you look at our present moment in time, there's enormous suffering. Whether it's in Sudan, in Israel, or Gaza, or anywhere right now, there's suffering. And so then the question becomes, what do we do about that? Mm. How do we react to the suffering in the world?
Right.
And I think religion, Christianity and Judaism, which is what I'm most familiar with, call out for us to help solve suffering and help, right? I think Buddha said that the ability to end the suffering of one person, and the same in Talmud, ending the suffering of one person and you save the world.
Mm-hmm.
So I think as a firefighter, that's how my response to that is being a firefighter and being there for people in their need. But I think we all can do better. I think we all can do more. And not a lot. It doesn't take a lot. It doesn't take a lot. It just takes us to say, how can I be kind today? Robin Williams, who I love, the comedian, who is one of my favorite people on the planet, committed suicide. But one of the things he said was that we all have to remember that everybody has a story. Everybody has something going on in their life. And that it's, you look at them and you wonder, how can they even stand up, right? And once you come to that realization that everybody's got suffering in their life, it's much easier to be kind. And it's much easier to follow the impulse to say, how can I help? I think, how can I help, is probably the most profound spiritual phrase we can offer as human beings. It's getting outside of ourselves and saying, my role is, I'm here to help other people. That's my role in existence. And I think whatever spiritual tradition you come from, that resonates.
Yes, I love that too. Yes, I have heard that phrase another part of it coming before that. Somebody said, I think it was one of the monks that I listened to, when I close my eyes, I'm at peace. And when I open my eyes, the question is, how can I help?
So that's lovely.
Yeah,
that's lovely.
I think it was a Zen monk who said that.
Yeah. And I think what's important is we need both. We need to be able to close our eyes and have tranquility, because it's a pretty chaotic place out there in the world.
Yes, gosh, this week, I could tell you.
Right.
I mean, directly.
I know. Exactly. And we need those moments of tranquility. And then at the same time, I think I always have thought that the way to kind of a true life is not solely through meditation and not solely by putting yourself on the mountain. There was a story about a Buddhist monk, not Buddhist, but it's a monk who just passed away last week, who had never seen a woman in his entire life, right? And I think that's, there are many ways to kind of a whole life, but in my view, the way to a whole life is by helping others, by being engaged. I think that's kind of my motivation every day is what can I do to help? Whether it's whether it's helping people or whether it's helping dogs. Mm-hmm. What can I do today?
Yes. Oh, gosh. Yeah. Yes. Helping dogs. Yeah. But I love the way you said that too, that everyone at some level, it's going through challenges. It's suffering sometimes.
Yes.
Even it could be just at the body level, right? The body's always doing something.
Right.
Might not be well.
Right.
Yes, yes. How can I help? What a profound message for all of us, not just to be in touch with for the first time, but as a reminder. That was a big reminder for me just now. Mm-hmm. Thank you. I want to thank you for that, Hirsch, as a spiritual message.
Sure.
You mentioned, we want to talk about the dog lesson book, but I have another question. You're just so interesting.
Sure.
You mentioned Robert Williams, right? He was very much engaged in that role, being an actor and being helping others, being funny, bringing joy and all, but he was not well. So I wish you have, I wonder how this is possible for some of us not to be well, and not even to be able to recognize a lot of times that we're not well. I wonder why, how can this happen when we seem to be doing so well helping others? How can we not be helping ourselves first?
It's a really good question. I think you step back for a minute. A lot of us are taught, and this is kind of one of the negative consequences of Stoicism, that we're not supposed to talk about our pain. We're not supposed to admit that we suffer. We're just supposed to kind of grin and bear it, carry on, carry forth. And I think, I mean, I suffer from that all the time because I have a Catholic upbringing, and I had and kind of because I'm an American male, Stoicism is kind of built into the system. So I think we have to understand we have to take care of ourselves. And when we take care of ourselves, when we're healthy, when I think both you and I talked before we started recording about how tired we are because of daylight savings time. Right? And so we need to take care of ourselves. We need to be rested. We need to eat well. And when we can do all those things, then we're better able to help others. It's very hard to help others when you are suffering.
Yes, yeah.
Although in the Christian tradition, suffering, Christ on the cross, here to save us all, is part of the package of Catholicism and Christianity. So
right,
Oh, there are my dogs.
Oh yes, of course they have to be here. We'll be talking about them.
Right.
So the idea of sacrifice, right, Hirsch? Yeah, right. I know in Christianity that's a very big theme, which I never subscribed to. I never really understood that.
Right.
That didn't make sense to me. But
nope.
But also the idea, it seems like it goes back to the concept of balance, isn't it? Loving ourselves and others at the same time.
Right.
Bringing those two pieces together, which it sounds to me like the byproduct of wisdom, really does.
Yes, yes. I think the idea of balance is really what we strive for. Don't you think? I mean, it's the ability to take care of ourselves and be kind in the world.
Yes, 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 yeah. And I remember being reluctant to this idea of balance because life felt to me there was never really, the balance was not a destination, a place to come and stay and live there. Because it might be that the other idea that I have heard that made most sense to me, the dynamic of balance, something that it's always moving, as we talked earlier about dancing. So it's always finding a way of dancing gracefully. I think that's knowing the steps, perhaps, right? Like getting to know the steps of a song and kind of always returning to it, having that memory, the body memory. So I don't know, that kind of makes more sense for me, dynamic moving balance. So let's talk about your book. So Dog Lessons, Learning the Important Stuff from Our Best Friends. The first question is, what was the main intention of writing your book? This book.
I think it was twofold. One, it was an opportunity for me to express my gratitude to having lived with dogs since I was 10 years old.
Yeah.
I think secondly, it is to help people wake up and understand what an amazing gift dogs are in our lives. They were the first domesticated species. And I don't like the word domesticated really, but they were the first species to that we encountered as Homo sapiens 40,000 years ago, 25,000 years ago, no one's really sure. And we became partners. And we have been partners for that for, you know, thousands and thousands and thousands of years. And I think sometimes, and maybe it's just me, that we take that for granted. But when you look at a dog, you're looking at generations of dogs going back far into time that have been with us, whether we were hunter-gatherers, whether we were agriculture or living in cities, dogs have always been with us. Yes. And I think I wanted to tell that story so that we don't take them for granted, I think the other part.
Yes. How beautiful. Yeah. You see that concept of gratitude, right? That it comes, mm-hmm. it came to life now to this conversation in this way. Yes. For me has been having a dog and actually looking at anything that we could easily hurt if we chose to. That to me is a practice of compassion, isn't it? Being able to see that everything is interconnected, that life is one.
Yes.
As you said beautifully in your book, you did mention that, which is another spiritual theme, the oneness of life, being able to see that,
right.
believe that.
I think the idea, whether you take it from a position of ecology or from a more spiritual position, where everything's connected on this planet. There's a saying that you in ecology that you can't change one thing because it's so deeply connected. And I think I live by that every day. It's like you go on a walk, and I think one of the things I talk about a lot about is just walking with dogs.
Yeah.
And you go on a walk, and if you're open and intentional about it, you don't have your iPhone on. You're not on the phone, you're not thinking of other things, but you're just observing, you're seeing the world. And it's, you know, I feel bad for people who live in cities on concrete, but when you get out into the country and you see the amount of life there is, whether it's insects, whether it's birds, whether it's plant life, you just get the sense that this is an astonishing place to be. And it's all connected. And we're responsible for that world.
Yes, right. And hurting, it goes back to that message. I think it's a Christian message about loving your neighbor as you love yourself. So hurting anything outside that seems to be outside of us is hurting ourselves indirectly. That world.
Right. And there's a Muslim sect, the Janis, Janis, and they deeply believe that they cannot hurt another being. So when they walk, they make sure they're not stepping on insects.
Right.
Right. Yeah. And they're very protective of the world. It's a little extreme for us, but it's an awfully amazing principle to live up to. To my responsibility in the world is not to bring harm to any being.
Yes. Wow. Yes, I love that. That's one, when I was studying Buddhism, I remember that was one of the themes too. Yes, one of the messages, mm-hmm. practices, mm-hmm. not to hurt anything.
Yep.
And I remember trying to really go deeper into that in the sense of living that truth. And I kind of ended up hurting myself again because I became a vegetarian. I didn't want to eat the animals.
Mm-hmm.
And then I became sick from it because I couldn't, I need some of the nutrients.
Yes, you need the protein, you bet.
Yeah, so that was interesting to see. Another part of that I realized is that in order to be here, have this body, I think we're already killing so much. We have caused so much pain. I think we are made up of lots of bacteria. We are killing them all the time too, like those microorganisms all the time.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know if that's realistic or possible.
No, I agree. Yeah. I don't think it's realistic. I think it's one of those things like, aha, here's how another group of people live, right? I can't live up to that standard, but how can it teach me in my life what I can do better.
Yes, right. Because
because I'm involved with dogs, right? And like 700,000 dogs. Is it 1.6 million dogs go into shelters every year because they're unwanted, and a lot of those dogs are euthanized. And we just seem as a society to ignore that, right? And so my wife's and my mission is to really bring awareness to that, to help with the shelters, because it's our callousness sometimes leads to suffering, and our unattention and our lack of awareness leads to suffering in a lot of ways with sentient beings. And I think we have a responsibility. I think it was Gandhi who said, you can tell the emotional maturity of a country by how they treat their animals. Right. And we have a long ways to go.
Wow. So true. So that's one of the sections in your book that caught my attention the most. It's walking in the universe, which you mentioned earlier about walking how with a dog. How wonderful it is. I was laughing when you talked about them, that they always see something new. They actually go, you can take them on the same path, but they always find something. They might sniff on the same place, but for them, it's like, how interesting to be here and just be smelling this.
Exactly.
Same thing.
Exactly, right.
And then you also... And
we can have the same awareness. We can learn to have the same kind of attention.
Yes, yeah. What a beautiful reminder. Yes, yes, yes. A billion times again. And then you say in the book, you say, it is important to remember that shelters are not a dog problem. They are a human problem. And then you say, here are some actions and standards I try to hold myself to. And then you mention them. So our pets have moral standing, so we cannot treat them like property. That's not treating dogs like property. Also, dogs, all pets are a lifetime commitment. That's a big one, right, Hirsch? What a beautiful reminder for some of us who just get pets for the sake of, I don't know, it's almost, some people feel like, I'm sad, so I'll get a dog. But then they have no idea what commitment they are making. It's not just because you said that you need a dog. There's so much, it's about them too, not just about us. And then you mentioned, if possible, try to adopt dogs from a shelter, which we didn't do, my husband and I. We got from a breeder. And I see that in our neighborhood here in Florida, most people, they have shelter dogs. And then my husband and I always wondered why. Because needed, right? So people, they're aware of that. So that's a wonderful thing to see around here. And then you talked about newly adopted rescue animals require patience. It takes time for a terrified animal to adjust to a new humans. True. And then also volunteering. You propose that too as a suggestion. That would be a wonderful thing to do.
Right. Right. And I think I get asked a lot, what was the biggest lesson that I wanted to impart about dogs? And I think with especially with shelter dogs, is the resilience of dogs. I mean, I grew up learning that the first 3 months of a puppy's life set their behavior in stone for the rest of their life. And what you learn working with rescue dogs is they're much more resilient. If you're patient, if you're kind, a dog that's frightened, that's traumatized, and most dogs are traumatized in shelters, but if you give them the time, they become incredible companions. And because they're resilient. They can bounce back from hard times.
Right. And so us human as well, humans, we have that ability. So it's almost like we are, by teaching them or by helping them, we can actually that reflects on us too. It helps us to become more resilient.
Exactly.
That's one of the dog lessons I have that here that caught my attention, resilience. And you're very practical too. So it's not, I mean, I love how philosophical you are, how spiritual you are. I just love that because I love philosophy, especially spiritual philosophies. But then I see that you're very practical too in giving suggestions. Here you you mentioned 6 ways you can help foster resilience in your dog. And then you suggest active coping, physical exercise, positive attitude, social support, patience, and help from experts. So all these actually we can apply to ourselves in a way.
Exactly.
It goes both ways, right?
Yep.
And absolutely. I love how you call yourself also a dog guardian. That caught my attention. So in a way, you're protecting them. It's not just that dogs are, you know, some people, they acquire dogs just to protect their house. They leave them outside, which I really don't subscribe to that. The idea of having my dog outside of my house. Zen is part of my family. We consider him almost like a son. Oh, you know, we actually talked to him that way. we never had children, so he's like, oh, he's our son.
Right. Same with us. Our dogs are part of our family. Yeah. Absolutely.
So resilience. Another dog lesson that you mentioned in the book that caught my attention was bravery. And I absolutely love the way you write. I mean, you're a great writer. You're such an amazing writer. That kind of reflects back to us. I kept thinking about humans, you know, dogs, humans. Yes, that can be applied to, I mean, they are teaching us, but in way, by helping them, by helping dogs, we're helping ourselves. It goes back to that fundamental truth again. It's everything is interconnected. So you talk about bravery in a sense of that dogs are brave. Then and you say, it takes you ask a question. What is the bravest thing I can do? So as a question. Then you said, being brave is not just being, it's not just about courage, but going beyond anxiety and fear. So that's another beautiful, beautiful reminder that dogs, they do that automatically all the time. They put themselves in that position and we can do it too. So you say it in that way. I'm paraphrasing you here, but that's the message that I received from you. Would you like to make a comment about that bravery? That's we need to hear more about bravery, all of us.
Right. I think just like dogs, I think we are inherently brave. We have a legacy. Generations and generations of our forefathers were astonishingly brave, and that they passed that gift on to us. Now, sometimes we don't believe it because sometimes the whole point of civilization is that we don't have to demonstrate our bravery because things are taken care of. By civilization. And so we lose touch with our bravery. But it's there. And I think my recommendation was, and it's simple things. It's simple things. Think of your day. Think of all the things that you want to do but are frightened to do, right? Whether it's telling somebody you love them, whether it's things like admitting you were wrong, all kinds of things that are little things every day. Choice points that we come up to. And what I ask is that ask yourself, what is the bravest thing I can do? Right? What is the bravest thing I can do? And that just gives you a guidepost to your actions every day. Because mostly we strive for comfort every day. If we're on automatic pilot, we make the choices that seem to be the most comfortable choice, not necessarily the right choice. And sometimes we can choose to be uncomfortable by choosing to be brave. And that's when we grow as a human being, because we say, that wasn't that hard. I can do that again, right? And I really ask the question, what is the bravest thing I can do? And that becomes a mantra.
Yes, right. That really, that did exactly that for me in that moment. I love the way you said that too. Even having the courage to say, I'm sorry to somebody, or saying many times, just telling them how much you love them, not being shy about it. So I have heard that exactly that before in the same message. It's not having less fear, but having more courage. So it's not about becoming fearless, but having more courage.
No. I think fear is a good thing. Fear keeps us alive. But sometimes fear is irrational.
Yes. Yeah, it can get in the way. It can really, really stop us from living the life that we are here to live.
Right.
And that's a powerful message that we can all, it really resonates with all of us. It's something that I have noticed here after interviewing so many people. Mm-hmm. Another thing mm-hmm. that you said, when you say, I love the way you say, every being has a purpose. That was within the Walking in the Universe. That also mm-hmm. caught my attention. Every being has a purpose. And it goes back, of course, to the theme of everything is interconnected and everything is doing, like dancing this universal dance that couldn't really happen without one another. Even the microscopic organisms, they are playing a role here mm-hmm. that we cannot even mm-hmm. We don't think of it. We don't even think about it, most of us. But
right.
what a beautiful contemplation to have.
Right. Right. The way evolution and nature work is that everything here is here to grow. Everything and everything is connected. And as you understand evolution more and you understand how nature works more, it's just astonishing how connected things are and how dependent everything is.
Yes.
And yeah, that's that again, it's about paying attention. My favorite poet, Mary Oliver, talks about be out in nature, notice things, pay attention, and then tell everybody.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And I think our first objective is to really pay attention.
Yeah, pay attention. That's because we seem to live in different realities, all of us. And right. And we are not present. We are in the past or in the future. We are actually operating through the mind most of the time, not really realizing that there is something else besides the logical and rational thinking mind. There's awareness. I think that's what you're pointing to. And I'm not sure if we can call it awareness. That might be the closest word or concept we can arrive at. But do you agree with that, Hirsch, that the word would be, or intuition perhaps too? I don't know.
Right. I think where I kind of come from is that we, civilization, you have to go back. So for millions of years, we were hunter-gatherers. Yeah. And that's how we evolved. And that's at core who we are. We're social bonding mammals, right? And civilization, I mean, agriculture has only been around for 15,000 years. And our civilization cities, like we live in, are a kind of really recent, only a couple hundred years old. But the core who we are is that hunter-gatherer. And you take a hunter-gatherer and you put them on at a train station with millions of people and people on their phones and all this going on. It's at some level, it's very strange, right?
Yeah.
And it doesn't really, it's, I don't know if it's not, if I, in one way, civilization brings us health. You know, we live longer, all those kinds of things. But I think it also does damage to our intuitions. It also does damage to our core being who evolved to be in a small tribe as a hunter-gatherer, and knowing everybody in the world, right?
Yeah.
As a hunter-gatherer, you knew everybody in the universe. And now we're confronted with, if you know, you're confronted in a city with thousands of strangers whose intentions you don't know. And that's hard. That's difficult for us. And we kind of push it down because we're told this is the way we should be. But it is foreign. It's strange for us.
Yes. Yeah, that also resonates true to me, that we are trying to adapt to an environment that we are actually... We can't biologically. We're not wired for. I wonder what's the alternative to that. Did we have actually an option? Because it seems like that's the way it has been. The human race has evolved.
Sure.
It's growing so much that it seems like that was the solution, right? For the problem, creating more jobs and technologically we are so advanced in all the food industry. So I'm wondering if we had an option to. Not to come to this point of disconnection?
That's a really good question, and it's hard.
Yeah.
I think it's a really difficult, it's not a difficult question, but it's how do we honor who we are and live in a modern industrial society.
Right.
And I think a lot of it has to do with family, to stay connected to your family, and to have friends. I think one of the things that's going on now is that we have this epidemic of loneliness.
Yes.
And I think the pandemic has a lot to do with that, that we are isolated in our homes. And I just can't imagine if I wasn't married and I didn't have kids and I lived in an apartment by myself for those two years, how difficult that would have been. So I think this, the response is, the answer to your question is, we need to stay close to family. We need to have close friends. We need to be active in communities. I mean, those three things, I think, are kind of the anecdote to the industrial world we live in.
Yes. Yeah. That's a beautiful suggestion that I absolutely wholeheartedly agree. Yes. I think you mentioned that too, community support. Oh, you do. So yeah, social support and asking for help when we need help. Mm-hmm. A lot of us have lost that ability to, for some reason, to be humble, right? We're almost at the end, and I have so many other questions to you and messages that caught my attention in your book. There's something that you say, you quoted somebody in your book, a French novelist that I didn't know about him. Milan Kundera, his name?
Oh, yes.
Oh, my God, I love that quote. It's under Philosophy of Dog in your book. You say, dogs are our link to paradise. They don't know evil or jealousy or discontent. To sit with a dog on the hillside on a glorious afternoon is to be back in Eden, where doing nothing was not boring. It was peace.
Isn't that wonderful? Wow, it's such a lovely, lovely line.
Yeah. Wow. That just, I was in contemplation for a while after reading this. And I'm still now kind of pauses me. Yes, dogs are a link to paradise, right?
They really are. I think of coming home after a long day and sitting on the couch, and both our dogs jump up on the couch and put their heads on my lap. And it's just the most wondrous, peaceful time to know that they unconditionally love you no matter what kind of day you've had, whether you're rich or poor, successful or fail, or what we call a failure. They're there for you, and they just want their heads on your lap, and it's wonderful.
Yes,
very simple.
Yes, right. That's it. That's so the concept here, the idea, the message was simplicity, and you do have in your book. You do talk about that. Oh, I can't find it now. Oh, yes, I think I did make. Yeah, yes, under a dog lesson. Keep it simple. That's where you mentioned that.
Mm-hmm.
You say if our goal is happiness, the way is probably a simple life. Dogs gives us mental signals. Take me for a walk. Rub my belly. Feed me. Life is good. Right. that put a
life
smile
is
on my
good.
Face.
Exactly.
Yeah. Rub my belly, especially. Right. I'm like, wait a minute. Right. When was the last time I had my belly rubbed? yes. That's beautiful. We forget about these things. So I love the loving kindness, of course. That's informed by Buddhism. The way you talk, you actually talk a lot about that. And you mentioned how to practice the meditation. Actually, you go through the process. So you say loving kindness is the first heart practice of Buddhism. In Buddhism, it is called metta. Practicing metta is a two-step process. So that would be wonderful if you could disclose that, share that on this podcast. Process.
So now I have to remember.
Yeah, if you remember. Right. If you remember.
Right. If I remember. So I think of it, I think the first process is awareness. It's just awareness of me and the world. And sometimes that takes meditation, which is a very powerful tool, obviously. And for me, I go back to being out with my dogs in the wilderness, walking with my dogs. And that brings me back, kind of grounds me in the simplicity and the idea. And then I think the idea of loving kindness, loving part of it, emerges immediately when I'm with my dogs. Because I love our dogs, right?
Yeah.
And they're the manifestation of that. And I love my children and I love my wife. Yeah. And I think just being able to feel that is important. I think the other part for me is then putting kindness into action, not just meditative, but putting kindness into action by going out every day saying, how can I be kind today?
Yes.
And it's simple things. It's opening doors for people. Yes. It's not getting mad when somebody cuts in front of you in traffic. Just keeping it simple and being kind.
So that's the practice in order to realize that in our daily living. That's interesting. Mm-hmm. A lot of people think of meditation. Some people, they think of meditation as something to just to ease their own pain, emotional, psychological pain, to be at peace with themselves. But they don't take that into the world. They're doing just for themselves to be at peace.
I think you need the both.
I agree. Yes. Yeah, that's another beautiful message. Gosh, you have so many messages, wisdom, really, in your book. Timeless wisdom, as I call it. So
thank you.
We're almost at the end again, but I want to mention also another lesson that caught my attention was the wild at heart. You say to be fully human means not solely accepting the artifacts of civilization. It is also accepting our wild selves to see us as part of the natural world. I would go one step further and say seeing ourselves as the natural world, not just a part of, but
lovely.
We are it.
As we are it, yes.
Wow, that was another reminder, beautiful reminder for me to be more wild. I try not to be. It seems like I keep holding myself back. I can't be that
wild. Yeah, we're taught not to be. We're absolutely taught not to be, right?
Yeah. And then another one that caught my attention, which has to do with my dog. I tend to feed him cheese, so I think I'll stop that right away. It was the lesson about the coyote fit. Where you say,
oh, coyote fit, right. Fit. Right.
Your dog should look like a healthy coyote. Coyote? I don't know.
Right.
I'm trying to pronounce that word. I think I don't use that word often. I actually don't. Coyote.
Right.
Yeah, that was a reminder for me because I give him cheese. My husband doesn't. So I'll stop doing it.
Right.
It's a lesson for me.
Right.
God. And then I love the ways in another one here, so many. Calm human. I don't want to disclose the whole book, but so many caught my attention. calm human, calm dog. Right. We reflect, right?
Dogs mirror our emotions. Mm-hmm. They're very good at understanding and mirroring our emotions. So when you're excited and you're agitated, your dog is going to be excited and agitated. Yeah. So if you want your dog to be calm, it starts with being calm ourselves.
Yes, that's another one. And sometimes it's the other way around. I have heard people saying that the dog, the dog mimic our emotions. Right, that's exactly what she said. I interviewed this woman. She was a dog whisperer, dog healer. And she said that. Animal healer, actually. She also works with the horses. Mm-hmm. So, yes, yeah. And something else, of course, we've been talking about empathy, right? Kindness is very much a reflection of that. Empathy. So that's one of the, to me, one of the biggest lessons in your book too. So get down on your belly and investigate the tall grass. I was laughing immediately when I saw that too.
Right. See what your dog sees. Yeah.
Yes. Right. That's the way you talk about empathy there. It's just so clear to me. Beautifully written as a truth to live by. And then, she's just full of wisdom. How can I ever stop talking to you? I'm trying, wait a minute.
Yeah, no, thank you.
Oh my God. Yeah. The dog, how to be old. That's another one. That's, another lesson about how to engage, death, right? How to embrace death, how to see that unfolding. So Nelly was one of your dogs. You said Nelly was my how to be old teacher. So talk to me for a moment about Nelly and also what's the biggest lesson you learned about grief and death?
I think with Nelly, she lost an eye to cancer when she was 8. She had to have surgery for an ACL tear in her one of her legs. And she had to be left at the vet to be kept in a kennel because she couldn't move around. But and every time we came back to get her, she was happy to see us. She was joyful, and she was stoic. And what Nellie taught me was that as long as I'm with my people, I'm going to go on, right? As long as I'm not alone, as long as I'm with my family, I'm going to go on. And I thought that was really powerful because she took it with, she just accepted it with such grace, yes. Right? And then one night, this is in January of 2020 during, at the beginning of the pandemic, we knew she had a mass in her belly and we knew it was approaching her time. But Nellie always liked to be outside. Yeah. She liked to be, sleep outside, especially when it was snowing. Mm. When there's a lot of snow on the ground, she wanted to sleep outside. Oh. So one night she went out and she was sleeping outside on our patio. And I woke up the next morning and she had passed. But I know she was in a place that she loved being. Mm. She loved being with us. She wasn't alone. And I thought, that's kind of how I want to be when my time comes. I want to be with my family, but I would love to be able to pass away outside under the stars. And that's what she taught me.
Yeah. Gosh, yeah, it made me emotional now. Yes, right. Wow. No, I didn't expect that. I don't cry as often here. Sometimes I do. Wow, that's beautiful. Right? I remember hearing somebody said, you know, I want to die alive. Yeah, I think that might be right. Yeah, that might be what she did, right?
Right.
I love being here, so I've died this way. That's where I feel alive.
Right. That's lovely.
Ah, that's beautiful. Oh my God, Hirsch, thank you so much for God, let me calm down first so I can speak. Can't stop crying. That's, I guess it can, what comes to me is how wonderful it would be seeing everyone living this way. Kind of reflecting more on death, that this is this experience is temporary, so why not even talk more about death and this with it? Why not? I mean, I love conversations about death, and I think it's because of its depth. It just brings us to you know, straight to truth. It doesn't take shortcuts.
Exactly.
It's just so powerful. Ah, wow. Thank you so much again for your beautiful presence and your shared reality. Thank you. So with this, I have to close.
Thank you so much for having me.
I love to end this way. Yeah. But would you like to add anything else, Hirsch, that you left unsaid or read a passage in your book?
Well, I think the gist of our conversation is it's a miracle that we're here. And it's a miracle that we get to share our lives with dogs. And I never, never, never want to take a dog for granted. They just bring me so much joy and happiness. And the idea that death exists is why we have to bring joy to our lives. Mm. And why we have to end, do everything we can to end suffering. It's because in the end, we all die. And that's what makes life so sweet. That's what makes life so sweet. And so I think taking a few moments every day to kind of reflect on that will really help you live a better life.
Yes. Billion. Ah, yes to that. Yes. Yes. I remember I interview a lot of people. So I do interview people that have lost their own children at a young age. Mm. And I remember crying here too with them because even though it had been so many years since they had passed, I could feel in their pain how much they loved. I think that's what I felt, the love. The deeper we love, the deeper we'll feel the pain, let's say. Not the absence of love. It seems like it's another expression of love. It really does. That's what it felt to me, another expression of love, just listening to their grief. And I say listening because just the silence too, it talked a lot to me.
Yes.
Their silence and the way they cried. Wow. And now the way you speak about Nelly and I mean, your book and everything that you're doing is just so meaningful. Thank you again, Hirsch, for being you, for being open to life to this extent.
Well, thank you for having me. Thank you very much.
So we'll be in touch again. And I want to mention your website. It's hirschwilson.com. I'll have that on the podcast notes. That'll be clickable. I'll have the Amazon link to the books, although you do suggest the collected works to buy from the store. I'll have that link there too, actually. I'll have that link instead, actually.
Oh, great.
Yeah, I'll have the books all linked to collected works. But I want to mention that it's also on Amazon just in case people want to buy from there.
Yes. Yes.
Thank you so much again, and we'll talk soon. Bye for now, Hirsch.
Bye. Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening. To learn more about Hirsch Wilson and his work, please visit hirschwilson.com.
To learn more about this podcast, please visit fitforjoy.org/podcast. Thank you again for listening, and bye for now.